Welcome to the Education Gadfly Show. I'm your host, Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Today, AEI's Rick Hess joins us to discuss his new book, written with Mike McShane, Getting Education Right. Then, on the Research Minute, Amber reports on a new study examining how educators taught about and framed the 2020 election. All this on the Education Gadfly Show.
This is the Education Gadfly Show.
What if I like civic duty and individual rights? Is that an option?
You're not in a bucket, David.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please welcome our special guest for this week, my original co-host on the Education Gadfly Show, Rick Hess.
Hey, good to be with you guys.
Great to have you back. If you somehow don't know, Rick is the Director of Education Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. Also joining us, as always, my co-host today, and for many years now, David Griffith.
Hey, Mike. It has been many years, hasn't it?
It has been. I know. Rick, do you feel jealous of David?
I do, but it's mostly like his youthful good looks, his cheerful demeanor. These are things we should properly envy.
I have a face for podcasts, guys.
Anyway, so Rick, I know this is not something that doesn't happen every day. It happens almost every day. It seems like, no, you are out with a new book. But this one is not an edited volume. This is one that you sat down and you actually wrote all of the pages with your partner, Mike McShane.
Yeah. You know, it's and we found we use verbs, we use nouns, we used the whole toolbox.
All right. It is a very good book. I read it. It's called Getting Education Right. Getting Education Right. And the right, of course, meaning both, you know, getting it right, but also getting it more conservative. And so we're going to talk about that today on Ed Reform Update. All right, Rick. So, you know, on this show, of course, we talked a lot about the crazy politics going on in our country right now, how that affects education. We have the Democratic Party, where it seems like they are mostly retreating back to the traditional positions and supporting whatever the unions want, you know, more money for this or that, more pre-K, smaller class sizes. The Republicans, meanwhile, seem to be in favor of unfettered school choice is their thing. You know, universal education savings accounts, give everybody a debit card and let them spend it on whatever they want. Not sure how that is considered conservative necessarily, but that is where at least many Republicans are going. Seems like that leaves a wide amount of space in between. And in this book, you and Mike write a compelling argument about a conservative vision for education. I've been able to listen to some discussions about the book, and I know one big question is always like, is the stuff you're for, is it even, what makes it particularly conservative? So let's start there.
It's a great question and a fair one. You know, so much. I mean, part of the problem with the way we talk about education and policy today is how reductionist it's become. Everybody's become a partisan. So it's easy to hear conservative and think that this means conservative as in Republican. Nah, I mean, Mike and I aren't really talking about Democrats, Republicans. We're talking about a set of ideas. It's easy to hear conservative and say, oh, so is this about Trump versus Biden? No, we have the great blessing of we're not political guys. We don't have to write in those terms. We mean conservative in the sense that there's a series of values, traditions, dispositions that we talk about at some length early in the book, that we are guys who are skeptical of utopianism. We're skeptical of bureaucracy. We believe in the importance of formative experience. We believe in the centrality of family. And so this is a vision of education, which is really both about how do you articulate that and talk about why it matters. Mm-hmm. And then how does it look when you try to apply that to early childhood, to K-12, to higher ed? So when we say conservative, what we really mean is how we understand conservative tradition and conservative mindset. And if somebody sees it different, God bless them.
Yeah. And I have to say, I really enjoyed the chapters at the beginning, talking through, helping readers talk through some of that conservative tradition. You know, let's go back and read our Edmund Burke, you know, and let's talk about the conservative movement in the 20th century and some of these big ideas that came out of it. And then what that means for these big debates today. And so it really does feel like it's saying, you know, hey, a sort of Burkean conservative view, not a libertarian view, which is there's a big difference, right? Which is why you are not just saying, yeah, give everybody just the debit card and let them spend the money. But as you say, that we want to protect the institutions that we have inherited and that bring a lot of joy to people's lives and play important roles. Let me ask you this question. Are school boards and school districts, are they institutions that we need to protect from this sort of Burkean, Tocquevillian perspective?
You know, I mean, I think one of the interesting things in conservative tradition is we both believe that, you know, as Roger Scruton kind of famously observed, that it's easy to break things and hard to build them. But conservatives are also properly suspicious of cartels, of self-interest. The reason that we believe in competition and are skeptical of bureaucracy is because it's very easy for political entities to become self-preserving fiefdoms. So our school boards are a little of each. For my money, the idea that we want people who live in a community to have a say in how schools in that community operate seems like a healthy, appropriate kind of intuition. The way it plays out in terms of school district boundaries, in terms of zoning decisions, in terms of the politics, in terms of how elections are conducted, I think a lot of this has wound up yielding self-serving behaviors that aren't good necessarily for kids or communities. So for me and Mike, I think the argument's probably not school boards good or bad, but what would it look like to take these institutions and make them serve kind of our common purposes?
Yeah. And, you know, even Burke, you know, he was famously against revolution, as in the French Revolution and the guillotines and all the rest, but he did believe in reform, right? And so finding that line is very important. You know, you quote Yuval Levin, your colleague there at AEI, in an essay that he wrote for a book that Checker and I put out before the pandemic, looking at the kind of a conservative vision for education reform. And you've all made the point that, look, in with all those years under No Child Left Behind and the rest of the bipartisan education reform movement, a lot of good things happened. A lot of progress was made, but conservatives had to give up some things. They had to kind of put some of their arguments and their priorities on the shelf. And maybe he was writing this back in, I think, 2018 or so. You know, it's time to bring those back. You know, now we've gone through these years of just vicious culture wars. And so I wonder, like, is that what you've all had in mind? Is that what you guys have in mind? I mean, is the notion that conservatives, this is a good thing that we're back fighting over some of these core moral and philosophical issues?
It's a great question. And as you know, the way Mike and I tend to approach this in the book is we say, look, conservatives made a huge mistake when in the spirit of bipartisanship, they stopped putting principles at the fore. We stopped talking about parental responsibility. We stopped talking about, you know, the importance of merit and the problems of fixating on racial identity. We just kind of let that stuff be in the spirit of cooperation. And that was a huge mistake because education is at the end of the day about the kinds of young people we want to raise. And that's got to be a start with values. But the problem today is it's all values. It's values disconnected from what those values are for. So you wind up with clickbait, with grifters, with people whose interests are less in education and more in generating a mass audience, throwing kind of crazed, using the culture war as a chance to kind of throw out applause lines and raise money. What Mike and I point out is that when you look at a lot of these heated debates, was, you know, Kip famously in 2020 abandoned its slogan, work hard, be nice, as a legacy of white supremacy culture. When you actually look at what real human beings say, all Americans nearly, whatever their race, are in favor of hard work, are in favor of kids learning to be nice. They're in favor of merit. They're in favor of excellence. They're in favor of mathematics where kids are actually expected to show their work. So for us, it's not about culture for culture's sake. It's about not being afraid to say things that to us seem plain, important, and true, and then making sure that those things are connected to practical solutions that are going to help bring them to fruition and make the lives of kids and families and communities better.
So, David, what do you think?
So it's so hard to object to any of that, Mike.
Well, no, but I'm not surprised because this is what came up at Rick and Mike's release event at AEI is the people, a lot of, you know, kind of center left people in the room raising their hands saying, I agree with everything you're saying. I don't know that what you're saying is conservative.
Right. I think sometimes what rubs people the wrong way is like the notion that liberals aren't pro-family. And that's not what you said, Rick, right? But, you know, I think that's, it's a great example, right, of how somehow we managed to create a fight where there isn't a fight, right? I mean, like you said, liberals are pro-family too, right? Like everybody's pro-family. Everybody is, you know, work hard and be nice. People hear different things. I sometimes think that the culture wars are really language wars, to be honest with you. I mean, I don't want to suggest that, you know, that the culture of Kentucky is identical to the culture of New York City. But I do think it's remarkable how much disagreement seems to stem from the connotations of an increasingly broad set of words that are kind of central to the English language, in my opinion. Work hard, be nice is a great example of it. I don't think people do disagree. I think people are hearing different things.
And I think a lot of us lost our minds in 2020 for a whole lot of reasons. And then, you know, I wonder if those, some of those Kip folks wish they could have that one back as a mulligan and say, all right, we were going a little crazy there.
You know, and I think, and that's fair, you know, and like Mike and I say in the book, you know, we've got very nice blurbs on, you know, on the jacket from, you know, Rick Hollenberg, who's at the Progressive Policy Institute, who's obviously the world's number one Al Shanker fan. We've got a nice blurb from Jal Mehta at Harvard, who's anything but a conservative. Because look, for us, you know, America is at its best when we have folks from different ideological traditions trying to put forward their best arguments, not engage in straw men, not engage in kind of clickbait chasing. And when we then allow people to get informed by the different arguments and then vote for people who will choose between them. And so for Mike and I, what we're trying to do here is articulate a vision, put forward solutions. And, you know, if lots of people say, you know, what you think of as conservative just strikes us as common sense, I'd be the happiest guy in the world. If it turns out that a lot of our fights are really about horrible communication, about being distracted by grifters chasing publicity online, and if we can help people kind of get past some of that, that would be fantastic.
Last question, Rick. I'm curious, is there anywhere in the book where you think you are drawing lines between your brand of conservatism, this Burkean conservatism, and the populist, nationalist kind of conservatism that, you know, has come to the fore in the past decade with Donald Trump?
Yeah. I mean, I think there certainly are. For instance, you know, Mike and I are both, you know, Mike certainly, given his role at EdChoice, but both of us are pretty much full spectrum choice guys.
Yeah,
I like education savings accounts. I like charters. I like magnets. I like all of it. And I always have. But there are folks who say, as you alluded to, hey, this is education reform. I think for Mike and me, that's nuts. Education reform is about what we're for. What are we for in terms of making sure high schoolers have good career and technical options so that they don't have to go to college unless they want to? What are we for when it comes to the values that schools are actually embracing? What are we for when it comes to embracing excellence and pushing back on grade inflation? That's not about a market. Expanding options for families and educators is part of that, but only a part of that. But I think we're also pushing back on the value stuff. I think there is a right and a wrong way to argue about the values. I think teachers using privileged worksheets is insane. This is not a good way to help students understand Jim Crow or America's struggles with issues of race. On the other hand, that we also have seen parents, right-wing parents, complaining about their kids being assigned Ruby Bridges, books on Ruby Bridges, that they're upset that all of the parents throwing bricks at the school bus were white. Well, guess what? All the parents throwing bricks at the school bus were white. That's just history, people. You know, Mike and I talk about the difference between state laws, which, you know, anti-CRT laws, which we think are good and defensible, which say that classrooms are not placed for performative politicking or teachers to work out their issues, and anti-CRT laws, which we think are bad, which wind up trying to stymie honest discussion because the people pushing the legislation don't want to talk about certain topics. So for us, there are these distinctions that can and should be made. We've made them. We've tried to make them on, you know, with people on the right with whom we disagree, just as we've tried to make them with folks on the left whom we disagree. But, you know, our interest is less in trying to pick fights and more than and more in saying, if you agree with us, here's kind of the vision forward that, you know, that we would hope folks would contemplate.
Well, that is well said. We will leave it there. Rick Hess, Director of Education Policy Studies at AEI and co-author with Mike McShane of Getting Education Right. Thanks for coming on the show, my friend.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
All right. We'll have to do it again sometime soon. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Mike.
Congrats on Education Policy Barbie.
Oh, man, I cannot believe that made the very first article. That was something.
We are, of course, referring to a wonderful tradition here at Fordham, our annual April Fool's Day Education Gladfly, with the lead article about, yes, a new education policy Barbie modeled after our own Dr. Amber.
It was, and even my little teeny thumbnail picture in the corner of Education Research Barbie. So I don't know. It was, I didn't think I'd make the lead, man. I thought maybe she might be at the end, but.
Oh, come on. It was great. Everybody loved it. Everybody loved it.
Hey, I'm even more excited that, I mean, obviously we don't have authors on these things, but I'm just here to say that two of my authored original ideas made it in, which is a first for me in all my years at Fordham. Yes.
Excellent. Which was your favorite,
Amber? The grading by emojis.
Very nicely done. I, you know, this is that is one of those that I worry somebody's going to take that idea and maybe run with it. My seventh grader, Leandra, actually thought, yes, that was very funny and inappropriate, especially I think there was a crying emoji for needs improvement grade.
That's right. Yeah. Fun stuff.
We are no doubt heading in that direction. Okay. Well, the calendar has turned. It is no longer April 1st. So why don't we turn back to the Research Minute? What you got for us this week?
Yes. Oh, you might not like this one. I think I'm going to get into a little bit of a culture war stuff. But it is a descriptive study out in a ERA journal that digs into if and how social studies teachers taught their students about the 2020 U.S. presidential election. Ooh, I know. Here it comes. They survey social studies teachers in 12 states, three considered left-leaning, three considered right-leaning, and six considered battleground states, roughly 6 weeks after the election. So it closed the survey in late 2020, December. They examine how teachers self-reported demographics, teaching context, and their ideology about civics, which I'll talk about in a minute, were related to what topics they chose to teach and how. All right, let's just get the elephant out of the room first. The glaring limitation and what makes the study, let's just say, exploratory, is a 5% response rate, okay? In part because they were surveying people, you know, right in the height of COVID. And so they admit that the survey is in no way representative of U.S. social studies teachers, nor of the states that they surveyed, because some of those states had made way more response rates than others. And in the end, they didn't find that the variation could be attributed to states all that much anyway. So they didn't kind of look at those buckets after all. But at the end, they had nearly 1,800 responses of middle and high school social studies teachers. And they still say, hey, this is the largest cross-sectional analysis to date on teaching about political issues in a field that lacks large-scale survey research on the topic. So there's that. In the end, their responding sample taught at least two class periods of social studies in grades 6 through 12. Again, it's descriptive. They've used just various regression models. They have this factor analysis thing where they clump civics-based ideologies into three buckets. So they classify you as a conservative civics ideology if you have, if you place values on teaching civics relative to one, civic duty, respect for laws, and patriotism. And then they say you have a liberal civic-based ideology if you value rights around broadening civic participation and individual rights. And they characterize a critical civic ed ideology with a value around challenging oppression and deconstructing traditional knowledge.
What if I like civic duty and individual rights? Is that an option?
You're not in a bucket, David. That's not a bucket.
Okay.
61% of the total sample taught the election weekly or more in 2020. Those teaching civics in particular were more likely than teachers of other social studies classes to teach about the 2020 election. Those holding conservative or liberal views, as I just explained, were more likely to teach about the election. So the odds of teaching about the election increased almost 15% for each standard deviation increase in conservative civic education ideology, while the comparable statistic on the liberal side was a 17% increase in the odds of teaching about the 2020 election. This critical perspective thing didn't show anything. So it was just if the teachers were sort of self-reported as having one of those other two ideologies. All right, as far as the 2020 topics that teachers most often reported teaching in social studies, they were the COVID pandemic, 87%, protests for racial justice, 69%, and the U.S. Supreme Court confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett, 60%. Among more perennial topics, those were more, you know, more time relevant. The Electoral College at 88%, the economy at 60%, and immigration at 46% were also regularly addressed by teachers in the sample. Then they controlled for teachers' sex, race, teaching experience, and a bunch of other background variables. And they found those with more critical perspectives on civic ed were more likely to report teaching about climate change and the environment, voter suppression, and peaceful transfer of power. If you are more conservative on the civic ed ideology side, you're less likely to report teaching about voter suppression, racial justice, and gerrymandering, but more likely to teach about the economy and immigration. And then if you're teachers that say, I have a more civic ed ideology, they're more likely to report about election interference and healthcare policy. And then they dig into, okay, are there any correlations between the civic ideology and what you ask kids to do? And they say that, okay, those with more conservative civic ed ideologies had a 36% increase in the odds of asking students to debate the election in class. And then teachers who are more critical ask students more often to discuss the election with their family members. And then those, I forgot the last one. There was another one in there, but I didn't write it. But anyway, the bottom line is their takeaways from all this is that teachers should, quote, cognitively consider their ideologies as they may encourage them to be more flexible and self-reflective in the ways that affect their teaching of civics, end quote. Whew, I don't know, you guys. It was it wasn't too rigorous, but it was largely expected. But anyhow, for your consumption.
Yeah, I like that recommendation. Check your bias, people. That is a hard recommendation to follow. Look, you know, there was a teaser of an article the other day. I think it was from the American Historical Association, maybe, that they have a survey coming out of history teachers and, you know, basically whether they think, you know, that there's indoctrination being taught in the classroom. And they basically say no. But I don't know, these civics teachers, I mean, if to the extent that you see these differences and they do seem to track by ideology and some of these things are pretty politically salient, it does make me a little nervous. Although I got to say also kudos to that 80 something percent of civics teachers who are trying to teach the Electoral College. I'd love to figure out how that thing works myself. David?
Everyone's against indoctrination, Mike. And by indoctrination, they mean whatever the people they disagree with hold most dear, right? I'm against indoctrination. That's why I think it's so important that kids, you know, internalize notions like the separation of powers and, you know, individual rights and democracy. Wait, that sounds a little bit like indoctrination, doesn't it? It's just the kind of indoctrination that many of us subscribe to. So I don't know. I think it's pretty hard to metacognate, right, your way out of this. I think we're operating with slightly different axioms. And I think they overlap a lot, actually. But I think that if you're going to, you know, when you do this sort of statistical analysis, you're going to find that people, that they do differ, right? And people have slightly different, you know, they have slightly different things that they hold really dear that they believe are at the fundamental, you know, at the core of what it means to teach people about citizenship and to prepare them. And I'm always amazed that, you know,
people tend to believe that whatever it is that they were raised with, that they grew up with, whenever that's challenged, they see it as some like, you know, well, everybody knows this, right? You know, how can we question this? This is what America is, right? And it's like, well, actually, no, America is many things. And what you were raised in isn't necessarily, or taught in civics class, isn't necessarily exactly what other people take for granted. So I think that the study is probably picking up on some real things. And I am short on solutions.
There you go. Look, and you know, we could try to tie teachers' hands more to try to keep them from having their own bias influence their teaching. But, you know, as a general rule, tying teachers' hands more is not something that results in great teaching and learning, right? So it is a real conundrum, you know.
Yes.
It's like so many things in education. If it comes down to, hey, if we have great civics teachers and they use their judgment and they try to, you know, be aware that, of course, you know, that it would be ideal for their students not to be able to guess their own ideology or political party, you know, that would be great. But in the absence of that, or if we don't know, do we have hundreds of thousands of great civics teachers? I don't know.
Overall, Mike, I'll say I found that the topics that were being mentioned were heartening, right? I mean, at a minimum, it did seem like these were sort of meaty questions or issues, right? And to me, that's basically the best we can hope for, right? Is the teacher presents, you know, the students with some difficult questions, right? Some thorny trade-offs between different constitutional principles or, you know, economic principles or whatever it is. You know, as long as they're sort of becoming more informed, absorbing the content, getting to sort of the front of the important questions and debates, I think that's really what we should be shooting for, because, you know, an informed debate is ultimately what we want, right? We don't want sort of unanimity in our public square. We want people to have an informed debate. What we don't want is an uninformed debate. And so I think the most important thing that civics teachers can do is to try to, you know, make the debate more informed.
Love it. Well said, David. All right. Well, thanks, Amber. Look, it's a 5% response rate. It's not great, but an important topic.
Don't knock until you tried it, Mike.
Yeah, sure. I get it. Well, fill in those surveys, people. All right. Thank you, Amber. Well, that is all the time we've got for this week. And so until next week.
I'm David Griffith.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.